From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Sarah Dwider.
And I'm Stuart Russell.
This week on War News Radio, Seeking Refuge. First, we hear about the complex bureaucratic hurdles faced by Iraqis seeking to resettle in the United States.
Then, we hear specifically about Iraqis who worked with the U.S. government, the incredible danger they face, and the difficulty in getting to safety in America.
But first, a roundup of this week's news. A suicide bomber hiding explosives in his turban killed Gular Haider Hamidi, the mayor of Kandahar City. Hamidi, who was a dual Afghan and American citizen, had previously lived in North Virginia for many years until he returned 5 years ago to serve in his homeland. The attack occurred while Hamidi was meeting with city elders to discuss the bulldozing of homes that the mayor claimed were constructed illegally. The homes were in a district of Kandahar linked to the Taliban, and the group viewed the bulldozing as an attack. The assassination is the third death of a key figure in the past 2 weeks. Ryan Crocker, the American ambassador to Afghanistan, said the attacks showed the desperate state of the Taliban after recent NATO military successes.
Attacks continued in southern Afghanistan the day after the mayor's assassination. In the capital of the Uruzgan province, a group of suicide bombers attacked a government compound home to the provincial governor, Muhammad Omar Shahzad. Shahzad narrowly escaped the initial insurgent attack and was trapped in the compound for most of the fighting. At least 19 people were killed and another 37 were wounded, many of whom were women and children from a nearby hospital damaged during the strike.
Abdel Fattah Younes, the leader of rebel forces fighting in Libya, was killed under unclear circumstances Thursday. Younes had been called from Brega to meet with members of the National Transitional Council, but was found shot dead along with two aides before he reached the meeting. Younes had once been a leading member of Gaddafi's government himself, and reports state that he was under suspicion of holding secret talks with Gaddafi's ministers. Speculation places responsibility on both pro-Gaddafi forces and Libyan rebels, but neither has been confirmed.
Contrary to the previous positions, NATO powers have recently suggested that Colonel Muammar Gaddafi may be able to remain in the country if he agrees to relinquish power. The NATO announcement hints at the difficulties Libyan rebels have been facing in their effort to topple the Gaddafi regime. However, in order for Gaddafi to remain in Libya in the future, rebels currently fighting his regime would have to agree to any deal, and American officials made it clear that ultimately, Gaddafi's future is up to the Libyan people. This statement also comes as Britain announced it would recognize the National Transitional Council, the leading rebel group, as the legitimate government of Libya. So far, leaders from the council have had mixed responses to the new NATO position.
Soldiers from the Libyan oppositional body, the National Transitional Council, have launched an attack on Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's forces in western Libya. Rebel fighters managed to drive out government forces from the towns of Jaush and Ghazia and continue to make their way towards Badr and Takut. 4 rebel fighters were killed and 10 were wounded. In addition, rebel spokesmen have reported that 18 Gaddafi soldiers have been captured. The attack is described to be one of the greatest pushes by opposition forces since the beginning of their civil war, and rebel fighters hope to continue to clear a route to the Libyan-Tunisian border.
After retrieving the remains of roadside bombs and other artillery for forensic analysis and tracing them back to Iran, U.S. military officials have announced that they believe that Iraqi militant groups are receiving Iranian support. This also supports statements made by U.S. Defense Secretary Leanne Panetta during his recent tour of Iraq. The U.S. military is now calling on Iraqi security forces to tighten border control between Iraq and Iran. These weapons are responsible for 15 American casualties in the past month.
This is War News Radio. After 2 Iraqi refugees living in Kentucky were arrested and accused of trying to send missiles and explosives back to Iraq earlier this year, the U.S. government has begun rescreening 58,000 Iraqis who are resettled in the United States. But as authorities tighten security measures, they add to the list of challenges that are faced by new refugees. Anki Tikirtha explores the complex process that displaced Iraqis negotiate, often unsuccessfully, to resettle in the U.S.
For one family living in a largely Sunni area of Iraq, whose names we won't reveal,
sectarian tensions recently proved deadly. The family head, a Shiite, attracted the attention of local militants. Groups came by the household with threats of violence and left menacing letters on their doorstep. Then one day, they did more.
It wasn't just a letter, it wasn't just people yelling at them. They actually had a bomb that went off right next to their house that blew up the room that had their infant child.
That's Ali Al-Saraf, a second-year law student at the University of Southern California, who's also the president of the USC chapter of the Iraqi Refugee Assistance Project. IRAP is an American organization that supports Iraqis who have been uprooted from their homes by the social, religious, and political ruptures following the 2003 invasion. Running on donations and grants, IRAP mobilizes law student volunteers and practicing attorneys to provide displaced, U.S.-bound Iraqis with free legal aid. It's urgent work. According to the organization, 2 million Iraqi refugees are scattered both within Iraq and across the Middle East, living without permanent homes or legal asylum.
They're in a limbo because they don't have any legal rights in the country that they're living in that they fled to, but they can't go back to Iraq because they'll face persecution.
The U.S. government supports refugees who are trying to move to America. Following the passage of the Refugee Crisis in Iraq Act in 2008, the U.S. Department of State began issuing special immigrant visas to Iraqis who faced threats after working for the U.S. government for at least a year. But the routes to winning those coveted resettlement rights are notoriously winding. According to Kate Norland, a second-year law student and director of the IRAP branch at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, the unstable conditions following the U.S. invasion caused approximately 4.7 million Iraqis to leave their homes. Many fled to other parts of Iraq, while others went to nearby countries like Syria and Jordan. Norland says that the U.S. government has its own reasons for advancing the resettlement process.
The United States has signed up to take on a large role in that effort because we see, rightfully so, a certain responsibility for causing that crisis.
Besides the special immigrant visas, of which 5,000 are available yearly to those with successful applications, the U.S. government provides other ways for displaced Iraqis to resettle in America. The Refugee Crisis in Iraq Act also outlines a Priority 2 status refugee track for Iraqis who worked for the U.S. government and affiliated organizations. Displaced Iraqis may also apply for resettlement through the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, or USRAP. Through this path, they must wait at least a year to apply for permanent residency once they've arrived. But relocation to the States isn't easy, even with these options. Al-Saraf says that the special immigrant visas aren't keeping up with the demand.
So as of now, there should be about 20,000 Iraqis accepted through this program, but instead there have been under 5,000 who have been accepted, and it's not because of a shortage of applicants.
So, Norland says that part of IRAP's work is helping refugee applicants navigate a daunting bureaucratic maze.
If somebody's applying for a special immigrant visa, that's a very complicated 7-step process, and each of those steps has little sub-steps underneath it.
Norland says that IRAP volunteers help applicants with tricky details, like filling out forms, preparing for interviews, and for background checks. They also aid in writing statements of threat, which explain how the applicants were endangered back home. But nothing is certain, says Norland, even with a letter-perfect application.
One problem is that for the special immigrant visa process, there's no review. There isn't even a mechanism in place for administrative review.
If Iraqis who apply for resettlement rights through the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program are denied, they can still submit a request to have their cases reviewed. Norland says that U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services may reconsider the application, even though no official appeals process exists. But Iraqis who follow the special immigrant visa path aren't given this chance.
If you apply for the same benefit of resettlement to the United States, but you do it through this special immigrant visa process instead of through the refugee program, you have no opportunity to appeal to any administrative body if you are rejected.
Norland says that Iraqi immigrants are often forced to apply twice, through the SIV process and the refugee program, in case the former attempt fails. It's a redundancy she finds problematic.
And that's a real shame because the SIV process was set up to make it easier for people who had a closer connection to U.S. forces, and therefore people who we maybe felt that we owed something more to.
other aspects of the process prove equally challenging. These include an interview, which is meant to clarify the specifics of a refugee situation. Al-Sarraf says reliving the past may be especially trying for refugees with fresh memories of torment.
Many of them have post-traumatic stress disorder, and so they are unable to provide a clear version of their story when they're interviewed. And obviously that's due to the great mental stress that they're under from PTSD or other issues that they may have.
Al-Sarraf also says that the social dynamics underlying interview setups might discourage refugees from revealing crucial details.
You have situations, for example, where you have a woman, an Iraqi woman, who is in an interview with, say, a male interpreter and a male interviewer, and she, by virtue of the fact that she, you know, all the cultural ramifications of her being a female and having to tell them that she was raped while she was in Iraq.
And for applicants who can't open up, the odds of resettling are bleak. Kalsoum Hassan, a law student and volunteer at the UPenn IRAP chapter, describes her current case. She's helping a man who was denied resettlement because he worked for the Iraqi military during the era of Saddam Hussein. But as far as she can tell, his involvement was strictly nonviolent.
He never held a gun. He never fixed a gun. He never killed anybody or was involved in any of the documented atrocities that the Iraqi army committed.
Hassan says that language barriers amplify the challenge of building a strong case. She remembers speaking with her client and trying to understand his work.
So when he was describing his role in the military, we had to ask many follow-up questions. And one of the follow-up questions, the answer to that was, well, I carried water. I carried water back and forth. And then the translator asked, you know, was this water for the tanks? He's like, no, it was for the people to drink.
Even though Hassan's client performed nonviolent duties, his link to the army weakens his application. So, Hassan is working to appeal the case. She hopes that reconsideration will give him a second shot.
They'll see that he does not fit the definition of persecution of others.
Meanwhile, at USC, Al-Sarraf is working with the family that fled the bombing attack. Even though their infant child was in the room that was destroyed, he somehow survived. But he'll always be marked by the violence. Now, living in Syria with severe injuries, he needs special imported medicines. Al-Sarraf says that the limitations of refugee life make these especially hard to obtain.
That's obviously a huge expense that they need to pay, but they, you know, being refugees, their source of income is extremely limited.
Al-Sarraf, along with the rest of the USC branch of IRAP, will continue to work with the family. He hopes to bring them to the United States, where they will find the medical support they need. But even with his frustrations about the hardships refugees face, he's glad to help.
There's this niche that these people need legal assistance, and so to be able to use my legal knowledge and legal education to help them, you know, find a better life it's a very fulfilling experience.
In college, Norlin translated a novel about an Iraqi military officer who participated in a U.S.-led revolt. Though promised safety by the troops, he was eventually hung for his involvement with the American military. It's a narrative of loyalty and abandonment that haunts her still.
We sort of have a history as a nation that's kind of vividly portrayed in a few key photographs from our history books of leaving people behind after trying to improve their country in some way, and in Iraq especially.
Norland persists because of what she feels is owed to the most vulnerable sections of the Iraqi population. But helping Iraqi refugees rebuild their lives goes beyond restoring a sense of stability and security for IRAP's clients.
It's also justice. They've done something that should be rewarded. And I'd like to see that happen.
For War News Radio, I'm Anki Tikirtha.
This is War News Radio. The options for Iraqi refugees to resettle in the U.S. are complicated, and the visas are difficult to obtain. But as War News Radio just reported, there's a group of people who believe the United States has a moral obligation to protect the Iraqis who worked for the U.S. government, many of whom are on militant hit lists. Eliana Bisgar Church examines the perils they face and the unfulfilled promises the federal government has made to protect them through the Special Immigrant Visa Program.
There's an imminent threat every time you are going home. You don't know who's walking behind you. You do not trust anyone. There's militia everywhere. A lot of people knowing us, recognizing our faces, so it's easy to reach us.
This Iraqi interpreter speaks of the dangers for those who worked with the U.S. Army since the 2003 invasion. To protect his identity, he preferred that we call him Khalid Zaki. Since the U.S. invasion in 2003, there have been many global media accounts of U.S.-affiliated Iraqis who have been hunted, tortured, raped, and murdered. The List Project to resettle Iraqi allies, a combined effort of U.S. attorneys and volunteers to help them gain refuge in America, estimates that at least 1,000 Iraqis working with the U.S. forces have been killed since 2003. Recognizing the incredible peril resulting from this work, the United States has created multiple programs to help Iraqis resettle in the U.S. But the promises made through these programs have not all been met, and as the time for the scheduled December 2011 withdrawal comes closer and the death threats increase, the need to fulfill the promises only grows larger.
Myself, I'm waiting since December 15th. I did the interview that day and I never got visa. I try and contact them and they say 6 months period. I wait the 6 months. I called them and they said, we don't know when we're going to get the visa. And they say, be patient. But being patient means I can lose my life. And I don't want to lose my life.
Militant hit lists have long indicated the danger, but now the threats are increasing. According to Agence France-Presse, anti-American Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr recently said that these Iraqis, especially translators and interpreters, are outcasts who need to be rejected. Shiite and Sunni militia groups have publicly announced a strategic plan to hunt and kill U.S. affiliates once the withdrawal is complete. According to the List Project, the published plan calls for 9 bullets for the traitors. Most real, the United States' deadline for withdrawal by the end of the year is fast approaching and has left Iraqis like Zaki increasingly worried about their safety once U.S. troops are gone.
Just imagine if U.S. Army left and our visas are not issued yet, which is very soon because the U.S. Army is leaving Iraq in December, which means we have 5 months left, no more than that. The U.S. Army leaves. What are we going to do? You'll see a massacre in Iraq. We feel abandoned and betrayed by the U.S. Army.
Michael Newton, professor of law at Vanderbilt University, maintains that the withdrawal will put the Iraqis who collaborated with the U.S. at huge risk.
Many of these people took refuge on our bases, in some cases took refuge with their families. They'd leave their homes. And then, of course, when we shut those bases down or we transition them back, they have no place to go.
Many Iraqis did not foresee that they would not be protected by the U.S., Newton explains that many felt the United States would help bring about a more stable and peaceful Iraq.
In the vast majority of cases, they were motivated by patriotism. At the very end of our Declaration of Independence, the last line of our Declaration says, we pledge our lives and our fortunes and our sacred honor for the sake of these principles. And so the Iraqis that stood with U.S. forces did exactly the same thing. These people have fought alongside U.S. forces, they've translated, they've saved lives. There are many, many anecdotal accounts of them literally taking bullets for American soldiers. I mean, you name it, they've done it in order to try to bring about a free Iraq based on democratic principles. They really risk everything.
The danger for these Iraqis is evident, and the worries regarding the U.S. withdrawal are not unfounded. When the United States left Vietnam in 1975, 170,000 Vietnamese allies remained, according to a Philadelphia Inquirer column by Trudy Rubin, and thousands were murdered as a result. Large numbers of coalition affiliates were assassinated after a British withdrawal from southern Iraq. In one case, reported globally, 17 translators were killed in a single attack in Basra. Members of the List Project and other groups across America are trying to get these U.S. affiliates to the States. They aim to help Iraqis navigate the complex resettlement programs begun by the U.S., one of which is through the Special Immigrant Visa, or SIV, program.
The National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2006 created SIVs for 50 Iraqi and Afghan military translators per year. The Refugee Crisis in Iraq Act of 2007 led to the so-called Kennedy Bill. As of 2008, it is intended to provide 5,000 visas per year to a broader group of Iraqis who were employed by the U.S. government and are now in danger. The legislation allots 25,000 SIVs over 5 years until 2013. The program has not been as successful as hoped, however, says Wendy Witt, an immigration lawyer. She created the Iraqi Refugee Resettlement Program through her private practice after serving in Baghdad's court system on active duty with the Air Force. Witt argues that the program has fallen far below its promises.
The program has been a disaster. And even though the Obama administration insists that they are behind this program, they've done nothing to fix the problems that have been in place ever since the program was launched in 2008. None of these issues are new, and none of them could have been called unpredicted.
The SIV program is not by any estimation fulfilling the numbers it had set for Iraqi refugees. When called, a State Department representative relayed that 7,063 SIVs for principal applicants and their dependents, or spouses and minors, have been issued from both programs. That means that at least 15,000 SIVs intended for Iraqis have still not been issued. Looking more recently, the State Department's SIV arrivals online data from 2011 shows numbers decreasing from over 100 in January to the single digits in March and April of this year. Khalid Zaki is waiting in anguish.
But right now, no one has visa. Seven people got theirs in March, and no one knows what the exception is for those people that they get their visas.
Zaki has been approved by the National Visa Center for his SIV. The problem is that the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad has yet to provide it, along with his passport, to him. Olga Oliker, a senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation, a policy think tank with an emphasis on military affairs, believes the delays are a result of a sticky bureaucratic process. In order to get an SIV, you must have documented proof of employment from a present or former military personnel and proof of threat. She says the proof of employment can be incredibly difficult for Iraqis to obtain. Many military personnel are impossible to track down, and some have already returned to the U.S. To add to the mix, media outlets like the New York Times have recently reported that there are new security checks for all refugee applications, saying they are the result of two Iraqi refugees in Kentucky who were indicted on terrorism charges. These new checks, according to the Times and the List Project, seem to be the reason for the delays. In June, zero applicants were accepted from the SIV program. The same State Department employee confirmed that delays in the program have been caused by new security screenings. Oliker says this is simply not okay.
Why has it slowed down like this? And it's incumbent on us to fix that, because yes, the whole purpose of this program is to help people who are in danger. So if we can't do it quickly, then we're sort of diminishing its value.
Witt agrees that the program is not accomplishing its purpose, and that the U.S. has a direct obligation to help the U.S. government employ Iraqis. Without changes in the program, though, she believes the government will never fulfill this responsibility.
The implication is going to be that Iraqi refugees who already have their applications in the system are going to see additional delays, that very few SIV applications are going to actually go to completion because of the security situation. Many are going to have to make the difficult decision to leave Iraq to save their own lives unless they make significant changes and fix the problems that are just rampant in it. I see it just going down as a complete failure.
Witt strongly believes that the State Department needs to allow representatives, either family members who might speak better English or lawyers, for example, to take part in the program. She says this, plus specific caseworkers assigned to each applicant, would streamline the program, helping people to navigate the bureaucratic process and thereby increase its effectiveness. It seems unlikely that the State Department will make such changes, though.
I believe people don't understand how much that the Iraqis that the SIV program was generated for has really helped us and the U.S. forces in Iraq. You know, our lives depended many times on our translators and other Iraqi employees who were able to let us know what the situation really was on the ground in Iraq. And people who haven't worked in Iraq, they don't understand that.
Likewise, Oliker says the issue has received very little media attention since 2007, when the Bush administration, under hot criticism, revamped its policies to expedite the process for U.S.-affiliated Iraqis to get their visas. Since then, she says, America has forgotten about the issue, and with the scheduled drawdown fast approaching, has essentially forgotten about Iraq as an issue. Oliker believes the delays with the SIV program are sending the wrong kind of message to the Iraqis.
There is a responsibility on the part of the United States government to make a genuine effort to take care of people who gave their all to help a cause that we went in espousing and not to leave them in danger as we withdraw.
Newton agrees, arguing that the U.S. government is tearing at its moral fiber by allowing so many Iraqis to wait with their families in danger.
The United States has an unflinching moral obligation to keep our promises. These people acted heroically alongside us. Hundreds of Iraqis have died, been slaughtered, been murdered, along with their families, for assisting the United States. There are many more that are left that we simply cannot abandon to stain on our national honor if we don't absolutely keep our promises.
Newton says not only will Iraqis be hurt, but that the U.S. will also suffer major consequences.
And of course it has an impact on both current and future operations. We absolutely depend on local allies for a huge range of resources and assistance. To the extent that we cannot get that in this or in any future conflict, it dramatically undercuts our military effectiveness.
So, how to change the program? The push, Newton says, needs to come from the highest levels.
I think it takes presidential commitment. It takes somebody who says, what are United States values? When the United States makes a promise, we keep it.
Until that happens, Iraqis like Khalid Zaki will be waiting. Zaki says that at his military base alone, there are at least 30 translators waiting with their paperwork approved, but with the same response from the U.S. Embassy. They cannot estimate how long the processing will take. If the U.S. does not answer them in time, they know they will have to find another solution to save themselves and their families.
Right now, we don't know. We are
in the middle of nowhere. We don't know if we go to the United States or stay in Iraq. If they don't want to give us a visa, let us know so we can take care of ourselves. Like go to another country or try to live in another province. Move our families, move ourselves.
People from groups like the List Project and WITS Private Practice will continue to fight for these Iraqis. Meanwhile, as the drawdown in Afghanistan also begins, Afghans who worked with the U.S. government will face increased danger as well. If the SIV program does not speed up soon, the wars may be ending, but thousands more lives may be lost. For War News Radio, I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
That's our show for this week.
Join us next week when War News Radio's Dina Sharhan takes an in-depth look into the unemployment faced by Iraqi refugees once they've resettled in the United States.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Clara Izupitis, Eliana Biscard Church, Dina Sharhan, and Anki Thagurtha. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Stuart Russell.
And I'm Sarah Dwider. Until next time, thanks for listening.